Hey, Brendan.
Hello, Alan and Jorgen.
Hey, gentlemen.
The Not a Thing podcast is up and going for episode 220. Merry Christmas, everyone.
Merry Christmas.
Happy holidays.
And happy holidays to those who don't celebrate the Christmas.
There's no joking. Christmas is soon upon us.
Finally.
Well, with any luck, you are escaping holiday music as you can to listen to our podcast. So we thank you.
Good call.
We're recording the show as we normally do in multiple places this week, as we do every other week on the show. If you would like to be in one of those places, or if you would like to record from your own place and join us on the show, we'd love it. We're looking for guests coming up for the future in the new year. So we'd love to have you connected to the show in any way, shape, or form. Just find us in real life. That's probably the fastest way to do it. Or go ahead and text us, tweet at us, all that kind of stuff, and we will get that set up. Let's see. We haven't had a guest yet. Now that we've had Jorgen on the show, I feel like it's almost like too busy to have a guest, but I think I would like to try it.
I agree.
I'm down with that.
Okay. All right. That's it. That's the word. Hopefully you join the show soon. We will find out shortly. In the meantime, we have a few topics to round out how things are going, kind of referring back to escaping holiday music. The season is upon us, and that season sometimes creates seasonal affective disorder. You may have heard of this. Sometimes it's abbreviated SAD.
SAD. Wait, is that what Trump's always tweeting about? He's trying to raise awareness for seasonal affective disorder?
Yes, he's very brave. He's actually very brave on this particular point.
Oh, I wish. For those that don't know, Donald Trump does tweet SAD a lot on every once in a while. I think someone wrote up all the times that he tweeted that, and it's sort of funny, but it is also sad. So the SAD that we're talking about, seasonal affective disorder, is a thing. It's a real thing, and it's been correlated to winter especially. So in the Northern Hemisphere, it's related to not having as much sunlight or not having as much hours in the day when the sun is up, or having more hours at night, which it sometimes boils down to. And it is correlated pretty strongly. I think something like in the northern kind of countries, as much as 10% of folks are reporting, the winter blues or some other kind of depression that that normally they don't have any time of the year.
We had an expert that knew something about those regions.
Stand aside, gentlemen.
It was recognized by the DSM. It's in the DSM-4 and now the DSM-5 this year as not necessarily a problem on its own, but definitely a factor if you are prone to depression or if you're prone to issues. It tends to be to manifest in the winter. And like I said, there are some correlations to it being related to light. So sometimes the therapy that is recommended is called bright light therapy. You essentially have a full spectrum lamp in your house and you just kind of hang out with it for 30 minutes at a time. It doesn't even need to be that much time, but it's just to expose you to that amount of light, not necessarily for, vitamin D or anything else like that, just so you get that kind of sunlight-like thing in your eyes. We've talked about this on the show in the past because I think it was way back in episode here, about that one town in Norway where there was, it's in like a valley, so there's no sunlight that comes in. In fact, Jorgen, you took us there, if I'm remembering correctly.
Tell me more about Norway, Alan. I'm curious.
Are you Norway-splaining to him?
Fantastic.
Viking-splaining, yes.
Love it. This brief intercut reminds me of I just resaw the Silicon Valley episode where Ehrlich Bachman is mansplaining to
yes.
the two women that have just hired him. Mansplaining and is when a man is telling women how things. It was hilarious, but anyhow, the town in Norway you are referring to is called Rjukan, spelled R-J-U-K-A-N. And for 3 to 4 months of the year, they're located in the bottom of a valley with tall mountains surrounding them. And for 3 to 4 months a year, they have no sun. And so they have mounted giant mirrors on top of one of the mountains so that the sun can be reflected down onto their town square. Now, we've been there, Alan, as you remember, and mm-hmm. I've been there several other times, and we think it's kind of for show. It's not actually a thing that'll do anything for sharing the sunlight with the inhabitants and battle this seasonal affective disorder, but it's a fun little thing that they've done. And they've, you know, you guys told me about it the first time, I think, so it has clearly gotten some attention all the way over here.
They must have just a blossoming vampire population there.
Oh, it's massive. It's massive. You do not go out at night.
So,
and, but on a related note, I actually suffer from seasonal affective disorder. And for many years in my younger life, I would find that I would be getting depressed and sad and lack energy in the fall every single year. And then one year, my mother put me in touch with some people that she had gotten to know, and they were doing this experimental light therapy thing. So at that point, it was brand new and different and kind of hooey. But I did the light therapy where once or twice a week I would go to their place and just like expose my eyeballs to this strange light, and it kind of worked. It did the trick. And years later, when I was living in Norway with my wife, who grew up in sunny Sonoma County, we would find the winters to be just tougher and tougher. And so we bought this wake-up light by Philips, which tries to emulate the sunrise in the bulb that it's using and the light that it's emulating. That's not the word. You understand what I mean. And so we would put that on and have it by the breakfast table because the breakfast in Norway in the winter is really dark because the sun is only up from 10 to 3 about. So we would have this light on at the breakfast table and it would be almost like a real sunrise on film and almost fooled us, but that actually worked. So those things are true and real and actually do work. But then we were all like, you know, let's just do the real thing, move to California. Are you in? Okay, let's do it. We've done it.
Is that why our real estate costs have gone up so high? Is that what's going on?
I mean, it's like Norway is a very, very rich country. There are a lot of people in money there. And once they find out that there's actual sun elsewhere, they're out of there.
They're going to convert oil into solar?
Yeah. Well, they should. It's, you know, it's not a good thing in the long run.
Oh, that's its own thing. And we'll probably have a topic about that.
That is another episode entirely, I guess.
But I'm it's nice to get kind of corroboration for real world corroboration for that that kind of fact. And I think a lot of it in reading about kind of seasonal affective disorder, it can often linger past when the season kind of ends, just because it really does disrupt your kind of rhythm about how and when you go to sleep and how long you're asleep and things like that. And that can last, beyond, you know, the winter time or past the point where the winter solstice when, you know, you cross over between there's more hours in the day or more hours in the night than there are in the day, that kind of thing. That just happened recently. So we should be on the way towards summer I say this, you know, all three of us living in California, where, you know, I've joked in the past, we have summer and not summer yet, right? So we're on our way.
I miss summer, regardless of our lack of real winter. I miss summer. I prefer that sad disorder, the seasonal awesome disorder.
Love that one.
Or summer awesome disorder.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah, we'll go with that.
I just briefly saw that they have now released scientific proof that the lights we watch on our iPads make it harder for us to go to sleep.
Absolutely.
So
blue light,
that might be a problem, more serious than, at least over here.
That's why you should use a Surface tablet.
Is that really better?
No.
No.
No, that's just no. That's not a thing. But
well, the NFL says it's not better. And they know everything about medical science.
Oh my gosh!
The way they protect their players. Oh.
Yeah. That's just sad.
Sad. Anyway, the I know
not,
that
not that kind of thing.
I know that the. Both the iPhone and Mac OS, and I feel like there's an app. There's got to be a corresponding app on Windows and Android and things like that that will kind of delete the blue light from the screen a little bit. It makes everything kind of orange tinted, which I think helps people think about sunsets and maybe not looking at a screen. that sometimes kicks in. I know mine kicks in at 10 p.m. Like there's kind of a there's less blue light in the screen.
Night mode.
I think helps a little bit, and at the same time, I don't know. I think not looking at the screen definitely means less light into your eyeballs that that keep it awake. But I think one of the other things that we were talking about, so speaking of kind of light and how that works, I think it helps to have kind of some amount of just, you know, self-care around the holidays and keeping kind of intact with things. I mean, besides the wintriness of it, you know, it is the holiday season for a lot of folks that whether you like it or not, right? And any restaurant that you walk into or bar is playing like 75% Christmas music at this time of year, which can be a little overwhelming. So again, thank you for listening to the Not a Thing podcast in the meantime. Hopefully we're providing a good escape for you from that. But another kind of thing that I've been using to escape recently is watching movies. I recently activated my movie pass, which we talked about in an insert episode here, about things. And I like it. I think it's cool. I haven't used it too extensively yet, but I did use it to watch a couple movies recently, and that has been really, really fun. One of the movies that I used to kick things off with it was The Disaster Artist, which was a movie starring James Franco. I think it was at least produced by him. I don't remember.
Directed.
Was it directed as well? Or
yes, sir.
Okay.
Yep.
But it was based on a behind-the-scenes book written by Greg Sestero, who is related to, and he's in the movie, The Room, the kind of famous or infamous kind of cult film as, you know, the worst movie ever made. you know, written and directed and starring Tommy Wiseau, who's from New Orleans, if I'm remembering what I learned.
Well, bullshit.
That's up for debate.
That's what he would love people to think.
Some say New Orleans, some say Poland, some say outer space.
Yeah. The movie itself, it's hard for me. It was interesting because I had seen The Room before, so it was good to see it. But the movie itself is not necessarily a parody of The Room. It's a behind the scenes kind of movie, and it does have elements of that they recreated different scenes kind of iconic scenes from the original movie, but it's mostly a kind of journey of Tommy Wiseau's character, as well as Greg Sestero's character and their friendship, and kind of the underlying kind of undercurrent of how that movie got made, which is sort of fascinating because it is amazingly terrible. I was trying to talk to someone about it earlier in the week, and they asked me if they should go see The Disaster Artist. And I said, I thought it was good, but you kind of need the context of seeing the movie The Room. And then when I was thinking about it, I'm like, do I recommend that they watch The Room? And I was conflicted. I'm not sure what I should have said.
I actively told some friends not to see The Room, but to go watch like the honest trailer of The Room, or watch, you know, find a clip, some clips on YouTube. That's all I really need to watch. You don't need to subject yourself to that whole movie.
I think I haven't seen the honest trailer of that. Usually they do a pretty good job of setting up kind of the major things. I mean, there's so many just strange and awkward scenes in the movie, because it is, it was written and produced and directed by someone that had never done any of those things in relation to a movie.
Or been on a movie set, or done anything in relation to a movie. He just had a dream. He lived his dream, man.
And no, and that is
that
really
spent $6 million making that movie.
I mean, it is a fascinating kind of story arc, hearing about it from that perspective, and I think that definitely comes across in the Disaster Artist as a film. But I mean, it is also if you've seen the movie The Room. So many of the kind of notes about how the thing goes, so many of the things about the different scenes, it adds so much more kind of texture to that. But at the same time, I find it hard to recommend to see the movie. In fact, Julie, my wife, when she saw The Room, she saw it as a Riff Tracks kind of movie. So Riff Tracks is the kind of one of the spiritual successors of Mystery Science Theater 3000, where they, you know, they make fun of the movie in this case. So she watched The Room with the extra soundtrack of people making fun of it, and she thought that that helped make it much more palatable as a movie, and you still get all the feel of what the heck's happening. So I thought The Disaster Artist was really fun. It has, and I don't think I'm spoiling anything with this, but they do recreate enough of the scenes in the movie from The Room that at one point in the film they kind of have them side by side, so you can see how lovingly they reshot these scenes in order to make them work with, you know, the current actors that they used. It was James Franco as Tommy Wiseau, and then Dave Franco, his brother, as Greg Sestero. It has a lot of cameos in the film too. So many folks from you know, Franco's other films. Seth Rogen is in it. Paul Scheer. Just so many other folks in the movie. So it's fun to watch. It definitely, you know, it does have some kind of sad moments. But I wouldn't say that you ever feel like bad watching the movie. You do end up feeling like, you know, you get swept up in kind of the momentum of what's happening at pretty much all times. It's a you know, I thought it was very fun to watch.
I enjoyed it. I thought James Franco was very good at capturing that Tommy Wiseau performance.
Mm-hmm.
I think the whole cast was really well cast. Like, everybody looked like the people they were playing.
Mm-hmm.
I'd also like that they got the entire cast of How Did This Get Made in the movie. The podcast How Did This Get Made, they're all in it.
So speaking of that, have you both listened to the How Did This Get Made about The Room?
I have.
Okay. I have not
and
yet.
I love it.
I really wanted to.
Because they did a whole episode of How Did This Get Made for The Room 3 or 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And then now, and I think they even had like Greg Sestero on there to talk to him about it. And
right.
At that point, he hadn't really finished the book, and it was just still a weird experience that he'd been a part of. But it didn't have that giant cult following, and yet, so it was a little bit of a different discussion. But then they had a different kind of episode now where they invited him and James Franco and also at times Tommy Wiseau, I think.
Oh, really?
Because they probably got easy access to all those people since, you know, Paul Scheer and June and Jason Mantzoukas were all in the movie, Disaster Artist. So they had them and were able to interview them more in like a regular film journalist critic format of sorts. But then they also had that episode replayed of when they tear that motherfucker apart.
How Did This Get Made is definitely a thing. That is a fun podcast to listen to if you're a fan of film, and especially kind of film that goes awry. I tend to, you know... I don't know what it is. I just must intersect that kind of sphere of movie a lot, because so many of the movies that I've seen and have, like, you know, kind of not fond memories exactly, but definitely strong kind of memories and opinions about, end up on that podcast.
have either of you, for example, seen the movie Virtuosity with with Russell Crowe and Denzel Washington? Uh-huh.
No, I have not.
And I don't think you should. I listened to an older episode of How Did This Get Made, and it sounds like a terrible idea.
So had you not seen it?
No.
Okay, all right. So yeah, for whatever reason, like I said, I have definitely seen that movie. It's real bad. It was in that kind of early 90s phase of... computers and virtual reality, and yeah, and it was amazingly bad.
It reminded me a lot of that. There's a Stephen King inspired movie about a guy who is executed. I had the soundtrack to it because it had a great soundtrack, but a serial mass murderer killer is executed, but then his soul goes into the power grid.
I know which one you're talking about, but
what was that one?
No,
Lawnmower Man?
No.
It was not Lawnmower Man, but I'll figure it out.
We'll look that up.
we will look that up.
But
we'll put it in the show notes.
But I definitely, after Disaster Artist, you know, I also saw, using Movie Pass, a movie that I know the two of you had seen, but I had not seen it yet. Which is Three Billboards Outside of... what is the full title?
Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri.
There we go. Which I thought was great. And I actually didn't know who had directed it walking in until that came up on the screen. And I was like, oh, now I know what movie I should be expecting.
It's definitely a Martin McDonagh movie.
Because when I saw the trailers, I'm like, oh, okay, you know, I saw Frances McDormand, and I immediately thought, okay, maybe what is this? Is this kind of Coen Brothers-y? Is that what I'm expecting walking in? And it was not that, but it was still fun.
I was very excited about this movie. This was one of my big expectations of the year, mainly because, well, I really love In Bruges, and yes. When I saw the trailer for this in March, I was like, that is going to be awesome. And then I saw it the week it came out, and there were many parts of it that I loved, but I have to say I was a little disappointed with the last 15 minutes.
I can understand that. Because it, I don't know, it's not necessarily satisfying.
Right.
Because it's one of those ambiguous endings.
Yeah.
But I feel like that kind of kept with the pace of the whole movie, where here, And this is a thing that he, the same thing he did when he did Seven Psychopaths, is he knows audience expectation, and then just for the sake of being contrary, will do the opposite of what you're expecting.
I see that, definitely, right? I mean, the when you think of a movie and you kind of have, there's some movies you walk into and then you kind of expect a rhythm to it. You know, we've definitely talked about that on the show with, what was it? Oh, I forget.
Save the Cat.
Save the Cat, right? When we talked with Jenny back in insert episode here about how movies have a rhythm to them that can be, you know, pointed out. I mean, if you watch, we've talked about it, especially with like the Marvel films, especially kind of the earlier ones, where there is that kind of like, all right, here's how it is. It's going to start out kind of good. There's going to be this very down moment in the middle of the movie, and then there's kind of this ramp, and he kind of gets his footing, and then learns something about himself, and then, you know, fights the big bad guy, and then succeeds over that. And so there's a very clear kind of rhythm, and you can kind of see that because that's how kind of storytelling works. You have to have kind of a beginning, kind of a, you know, rising action, climax, falling action, all that kind of stuff. It's just drilled in from movie after movie after movie. And seeing this, it has kind of an element of like a there's sort of a mystery going on. There's sort of a, like, maybe there's kind of corruption in the police department kind of thing, which I think was really interesting because when I saw it, I keyed that and thought, wow, they're really, are they really making this about kind of a, you know, police department that might be corrupt? And it doesn't really go that way either. And so there's lots of different twists because you kind of are expecting, you're like, okay, well, what's going to happen next with this guy? Because is he going to be, you know, he's the bad guy. He has to be. And then it's like, nope, nope. And this is a very, you know, it adds so much more nuance to all of the characters to the point where, like, looking for like a traditional story arc almost doesn't need to be there because those characters are so well built and textured and surprising that I thought that was much more satisfying to me than the actual kind of arc of the movie.
Yes, I hear what you're saying. And I know that you're probably right, but...
But you want a resolution.
Everything that led up to my favorite actor, Wendell Pierce. No, that's not his name. But the guy from The Wire. Lester from The Wire.
Mm-hmm.
Everything yes. that led up to him saying, "You've done good. You've done good, boy." Everything that led up to that was absolutely fantastic. I loved every moment of Francis sneering upper lip. And it was just an excellent movie. But they'd played us so much up to that point of being like a redemption tale for Sam Rockwell, which is, you know, being one of the world's greatest Sam Rockwell fans, I think he should have in many movies. But then to have that be taken away and just be like unresolved, and then they played it up like toying with our emotions of that guy being the guy, and then it's just like, well... It is, but he's also not. We can't prove that. And also he's like special ops or like secret war, Iraq, sand country.
Yeah,
and
that did like, seem, yeah! That did seem like kind of a low blow kind of coming in. Although, you know, frankly, when they introduced that kind of scene, I'm like, this is too much. This can't be kind of how this goes. This is like, because that's what... you know, was in the letter that that Woody Harrelson's characters wrote. Like, you know, sometimes it, or I don't think he, that was maybe even spoken in the movie where he said that, you know, these things are solved not by detective work, but like just someone stumbles into it. And it's like, yeah. It was too much that was set up, or at least I felt that going in. And so I didn't feel too surprised. It is kind of a gut punch when that pays off, but it's like, ah, you know.
I didn't feel like it was a betrayal. I felt like it was the realist. Like he sets up peak movie situations and then resolves them in a realistic way.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Like he's. I think he's a filmmaker who knows movies and knows what people want.
And then it's an asshole. The opposite. Exactly.
Like, nobody wants to see what Brendan Gleeson does in Bruges. Like, that's not how you want that movie to end.
Uh-huh.
But it's beautiful.
I agree. But speaking of Martin McDonagh, I saw Seven Psychopaths again recently. And I didn't like it that much.
See, I the first time I saw it, I did not like it. But that's because I was expecting a red meat action movie.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
And again, with this one and with that one, and even with Bruges to a degree, it's okay. Hollywood is expecting me to make this big violent movie, and that's not what he doesn't want to give people what they want. He's going to give them what he wants
mm-hmm.
as a filmmaker.
But with this one, I felt like it didn't have an actual story that I could cling to apart from those two guys just making shit up.
Yeah, that's true.
So, like, there's nothing. It doesn't. If you're telling someone, what's that movie about? Well, it's about a writer and his buddy who's a failed writer and a failed actor trying to put together a movie about seven psychopaths. Oh, and how do they do that? Well.
Yeah, I think he got a big contract after doing In Bruges.
Yeah.
Because it's an amazing movie.
Yeah, absolutely. Agree.
And he didn't know what to do, so he wrote a movie about not knowing what to do.
Yep.
He's going to get that paycheck.
Well, I think, you know, the like I said, the movie is more journey than kind of destination, right? You know, I think the way he writes kind of characters was phenomenal for this. I mean, all of the characters.
Frances McDormand's an awful character. She's a horrible person in
right,
this movie.
Right. And yet you start out and you're like, you want to be sympathetic, but she throws so many things out that are like, no, that's bad. I don't want to see that happen. You know, like the scene, you know, we'll just take blood from everyone in the town and then do the match. And Woody Harrelson's characters is like, well, there are civil liberties issues at play there.
You know? No,
go ahead.
Go ahead.
One of my favorite scenes is when she comes home to find the priest in the house.
Yeah.
Mm.
That was beautiful.
Oh, man. The interplay between her and the son there.
Yes.
Magical.
Yeah, everyone's performances.
Also the flashbacks to when the night of the daughter, when the daughter left.
Mm-hmm.
That was brutal.
That was pretty hardcore right there. This, yes. But all in all, very, very good.
No, I'm fine with giving everyone an award in that movie.
Give
an award to Woody Harrelson, give an award to Frances McDormand, give an award to Sam Rockwell.
Except whoever wrote the last 15 minutes.
Okay, so don't give an award for writing to Martin McDonagh.
Yeah, that doesn't work for me. It doesn't work.
Poor Peter Dinklage. Like,
right.
Yes. Oh, well, that scene as well. That scene in the restaurant. Oh, my God. That was genius.
So the girlfriend, so the young girlfriend Penelope, that's fantastic. Hugo Weaving's niece.
Yep.
Really?
Yeah.
The stuff you know. I thought that was really good. I like that a lot.
It's a very funny movie that also was very emotional. And I recommend. I saw it twice. I really enjoyed it.
I've only watched it once so far, but it is on my list to watch again. Highly recommended.
Well, kind of speaking of movies that I think kind of go in directions that you don't expect.
The Room?
Here is a movie, right, here is a movie. I mean, I think the next movie we're going to talk about is one that I think I enjoyed, but it definitely went in a direction I didn't expect. Brandon, do you want to take that off?
Let's do it.
This little film, Star Wars The Last Jedi?
Yes.
A modest opening was a $220 million opening weekend.
Yeah, I saw it opening weekend. I was able to see it on Sunday, so that worked out.
I saw it opening night.
When is opening night for movies nowadays? It used to be that was
Thursday. Now it's Thursday.
It's Thursday? I don't
know. To make you have to wait till midnight, and now I got a nice 7:45 showing.
In the morning?
No, p.m.
Oh.
Oh, so it's not even Thursday midnight?
No, because people get an advantage.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. Well, in any case, I don't know. I had not seen it, opening day. So I'd heard some buzz from folks. There are a couple of people that I know that saw it, and their reaction was almost universally, so it's good, but, and then they kind of don't want to tell me anything because they didn't want to spoil it. We're definitely moving into spoiler territory at this point. We've been kind of good about it. The last few times we've been talking about movies, but I suspect we're going to spoil this movie just a little bit. So fair warning.
Not as much as Rian Johnson spoiled it.
What did he do?
So that's it. So did you not see it, Jürgen?
I've seen the movie.
Okay. Okay.
Well, I'm saying he spoiled the movie. Like, it's not great.
Really? Is that your opinion that comes out of it?
In that sense. Got it.
I've been saying there was a lot to unpack. There was a lot to think about.
Uh-huh.
I liked it, but I have some serious problems with it.
So
hit me.
I feel like it hits right in that nice middle of the all the Star Wars movies.
So I will agree with you. I will agree with you, to a degree. There's definitely things that don't work. There are things that miss. But I think the kind of thing that comes out of the movie is that, there were a lot of expectations about it because Star Wars is huge, right? There's so many expectations that come with every movie. The way that the movies are kind of woven together, kind of fit in a very kind of, not a pattern, shall we say, but really kind of a kind of an archetype of, good over evil and big triumph and kind of big themes. And this movie doesn't kind of fit with that. It takes a backseat to the way that, in the way that it kind of builds a lot of the characters and a lot of the situations. I think if there's one thing that I actively disliked was that it builds too many kinds of actions and situations, and then closes off a lot of the kind of bigger questions in a way that I thought was unsatisfying. For example, in The Force Awakens, there's the whole, like, who is this Snoke character? Where does he come from? What is his big deal? And you kind of get the sense, okay, yes, he's bad. All right, I get that. And then there's kind of nothing that comes from that. Nothing at all.
You will no longer care about that.
Like, it pretty much doesn't matter. I mean, unless he comes back as, like, a Force ghost or something to haunt different characters, it's like, well, doesn't matter. He was just kind of a plot device for that. And there are a couple plot lines that were introduced in The Force Awakens that close off in that way in this movie. And I thought that that was an odd choice, seeing that this isn't the, they've already kind of espoused this to be a trilogy of movies, and this is the second movie, but it felt like this is not the second movie. This is like the third movie, and there's going to be like a very short movie right after this to kind of close off anything left. Like it's very interesting because I literally do not know what they're doing for the third movie in this if it were a trilogy.
Nobody does.
So in that respect, I actually liked it, but I can absolutely see how it's unsatisfying on a lot of different levels.
Rian Johnson is Kylo Ren. Like, he has to kill the past.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah,
you have to kill your past. That's the theme of the movie.
That's a major theme.
Unforgiving, yeah. It is an unforgiving job to have. And I come at this, as you both know, I'm not a big Star Wars guy. I enjoy the movies now and then, but I've not seen them and loved them as a child and have grown up and had expectations and all that kind of stuff. I just, like, I enjoy them for and can come at them then with sort of like a neutral approach. And I thought the last one, The Force Awakens, it's kind of like a remake of the original one, A New Hope.
Yeah,
and yes. A reset, and like okay, let's get rid of the hooey prequels and all that ridiculousness and start on our new adventure together. So we bring in these and these old characters, and we bring in this and this plot line, and la-di-das, you will all, this is familiar territory. Rian Johnson, you do the new stuff. And so he's given a little bit of a thankless task to try to like out J.J. Abrams or follow J.J. Abrams, who just kind of like ripped off the tablecloth and all the silverware was standing. In a sense, which is a terrible metaphor, but that's the one I got.
So there is a lot in this movie I like. There are a lot of sequences I like. I like characters. It felt really long, and it was really long. Like, it felt as long as it was.
Yeah, it was definitely 2.5 hours, and it really, really felt like it, especially because, and I think this is, this kind of relates to what we were talking about Three Billboards, which is like the rhythm is definitely different than The Force Awakens or really any of the other Star Wars movies. Like, where you think, or at least where I thought the movie would have kind of a hinge point and a climax, it kind of had it and then was like, we're going to do another one. Here we go. We're going to do another kind of, this is a climactic, very important sequence. And then like the kind of normal kind of rhythm of the movie is disrupted, and it's kind of confusing, or at least it was to me. Like, I don't, like, I can't tell if this is the last scene or not, right? The fight in the kind of in Snoke's like Supreme Leader room or whatever, very climactic, very, very cool. And at the same time, it's like, that is not the climax of the movie.
That was one of the best fight scenes in a Star Wars movie.
For sure.
If easily. Not the best.
Yeah.
Like, that was the first time I felt like anyone was in any kind of danger in a Star Wars movie. Mm-hmm. But I think this, there is an amazing movie inside this movie. It just needed editing.
Well, he had already edited it down by 45 minutes.
Then either you go longer or you make it shorter, but this length was wrong. Like, we don't need the... I mean, I was fine with the going to the casino planet with Canto Bright. I don't
think... You
like
that part?
I actually enjoyed that part. Yeah. I didn't enjoy them breaking out those creatures and going on a long riding adventure. Like, that was a waste of
peculiar.
Time.
That did you like the porgs?
I did like the porgs. How did you like the porgs? I wanted to hate the porgs, and I fucking love the porgs.
That's because of their giant eyeballs.
They're puffins.
Did you
hear why they included them in the movie beyond toy licensing? So when they were filming on that island, there were puffins everywhere, and it was easier for them to digitally turn those puffins into creatures than to remove them from the movie.
Wow.
Oh, that's nice.
It's a bird sanctuary.
That is awesome. I was not aware of that.
That's great.
How did you guys feel about the humor? Like, from the very first scene where Brendan Gleeson Jr., Domino, is made fun of with your mother jokes, in a sense.
And can you hear me now?
Can you hear me now? I laughed out loud. I thought that was hilarious. But I do know that that is not really the kind of regular Star Wars humor jokes that you people are used to.
Well, that's because it was actually funny.
What do you mean, you
it
people?
Wasn't dad jokes.
What do you mean, you people?
Oh, now I just want to watch Tropic Thunder. Okay.
Yes. Right. Also an excellent comedy.
I feel like there are three scenes to cut in this movie that make it a great movie.
Ooh. I can't wait.
Oh.
If you cut the creature chase scene on the casino planet.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
If you cut the Leia pulling herself back into the ship with the Force bullshit.
Yeah.
For all the right reasons.
Yeah.
And if you cut the scene where Rose stops Finn from destroying the laser, if you take those three scenes out, it's a good movie. Like, solid.
And all the build up to each of them.
Yeah. Interesting. Interesting. I agree with you. I think some of the stuff that kind of comes in, and the thing that, this is the Star Wars nerd in me kind of jumping out, is like they kind of rewrote the rules for different things about the Force again. And
that's not how the Force works.
And you mean it's not about mitochondrions?
Well, okay, I'm fine with them, like, kind of unwriting that, you know, that bit out. But actually, I do like that they changed, you know, that they kind of remove the kind of weird hereditary link of the Force, especially because, like, I thought that the Jedi aren't supposed to, like, take mates and stuff like that. So how do they know that hereditary Force stuff even works if they never get married and have kids or whatever? But maybe that's just me thinking about things too strongly. But in any case, the like, okay, well, this one guy can now link minds of people that have the Force. It's like, oh, okay, all right. They can now project, like, a an image of yourself with kind of physical kind of actualities. I'm less on board with, and then Yoda just calling down a bolt of lightning and burning this tree kind of just for fun. I'm like, no, that's not okay. Like, if you have that all-powerfulness of it, why would you do that for, like, burning the... I don't know.
So here's the thing. The last movie was called The Force Awakens.
Sure.
So I feel like it's perfectly fine resetting what powers are powers. I mean, there is somewhat of a precedent of the telekinesis thing. Like, Luke and Leia, because they were Force twins, could communicate across large distances. So, I mean, this is a stronger version of that.
Okay. All right.
And I'm still not convinced that Rey's not their kid.
God.
Because it's very from a certain point of view thing.
Rian Johnson chose to not discuss that story. Wait, exactly. What? Whose kid?
I think she could still be a twin.
Of
Kylo Ren.
Oh, because I thought you said Luke and Leia, and I was like, hold the phone. We're talking different kind of powers.
I was happy to see Yoda back as a puppet.
Me too.
And, like, a decent-looking puppet. Like, that whole... I think, honestly, this whole movie might be Mark Hamill's best performance in anything.
Easily.
Anything non-Joker related.
Thank you. Thank you. I was just about to disagree with you. Okay.
Well, that's only voiceover.
Okay. True.
That's still a performance, and it's still really good.
True.
But
it is.
But I do like that. And this is probably a major point of contention with folks, is that I do like the way that they had that theme of you have to kind of kill the past and kill your masters and kill the things that you think are great in order to kind of move ahead. I really enjoyed that as a theme, and that kind of comes out in, like, Luke's thing too. It's like, I was built up to be a legend and I failed. Also bringing that aspect kind of to fore too, like, you know, embracing failure. It's like it really subverted so many themes that come from the prior Star Wars movies. I totally get that kind of breaks how people think of the Star Wars movies. At the same time, I think it's a more kind of nuanced movie, but that isn't necessarily why you go to see Star Wars, so that's hard.
I think this was the movie they had to make if they want to keep making Star Wars movies for the next 20 years and get their billions of dollars back. Like, you can't just keep redoing the same thing.
Right.
Which is why I am actually excited to see what Rian Johnson does with his own trilogy. Mm-hmm. As much as I have issues with this movie, I'm still looking forward to it.
Yeah.
I mean, he is an excellent director, in my opinion. So I'm very excited to see where he takes this next. He has kind of tied himself down a little bit to the franchise now, but with more power to shape that franchise, hopefully, within Kathleen Kennedy's vision.
One thing that I've heard people complaining about is the whole being able to track ships through hyperspace. They solved that with Rogue One. Because when they're on the planet trying to get the Death Star plans in Rogue One, one of the files that she finds is hyperspace tracking. They've been developing this technology for 20 years. So take that, Internet.
I'm
take that, Internet.
No, I'm fine with that because I saw the first episode of Battlestar Galactica, so that was fine. Which it really, really felt like for a lot of the movie. And I think that's fine. You know, echo that. That's a great episode. It might be one of the best episodes of that series. But I think the other thing that was kind of difficult for me was just the way they did kind of the hopelessness kind of built in. Like, I thought they hit it a little too hard. Like, it's like, okay, I get it. It's going really bad. It's going really, really bad. Like, every turn was, it's getting really, really bad. And you don't get that sense that it's going to turn around. And so it makes me think that when they do turn it around, it's going to feel cheap or in kind of a weird Deus Ex Machina kind of way. So I'm you know, again, it does leave me intrigued. But this movie, I think, doesn't work without the context of the other movies, and that is also a hard thing.
What do you guys think of Oscar Isaac's role in this?
I don't think he fit into the current climate.
I mean, I think I think the reason his character kind of worked in the first movie doesn't, I think Brendan's right, it doesn't fit into how this movie kind of sets things up and makes things work. At the same time, I thought that the way, I can't remember her name, but...
Laura Dern?
Laura Dern, yeah, I can't remember her character's name, but I can't remember...
Her character name was Holdo.
Holdo, Admiral Holdo. Like, her, that interplay with him was like, why don't you just resolve this? I mean,
right?
Just say the words. This is what's happening, right? It's that classic trope in, like, if you just communicate, there would not be an issue here.
I had the same problem with that as I did with Marvel Civil War.
Yeah.
Which is like, if characters sat down for 5 minutes and talked,
yep,
this would not be a plot line.
Right.
Like, that needs to not happen.
Yeah.
I agree.
Also, can either of you explain to me why the First Order didn't just, like, hyper jump ahead of them and wait?
Did they know where they were going?
They didn't seem to be changing course.
Well, I don't know. That did seem a little weird. I guess the theory behind that is that the rebel ships move faster, so you can't catch up to them. Although that does seem a little dorky.
Well, no, that's the whole plot of the thing in the movie.
Yeah.
Is they can't get them because they're too fast, yeah, but they could just hyper jump ahead of them wait.
I thought that was an unnecessary kind of like tension builder. Like, we have this countdown of this thing happening, especially because I don't think that that's a realistic time frame for them to do whatever they needed to do. So that was hard too. It's it does have some issues. I think they're the theme that I was getting from that movie is that most of the issues were resolved in a way that I did not expect, whether that was a good way or a bad way. It was at least sort of like subverting the expectations of folks coming in. You know, like Benicio del Toro's character are like, oh, okay, well, this is going to be kind of a cool, like, he's like the new Han. Okay, I can go with that. And then they turn it around, and you're like, ah.
I'm fine with that, because I suspect in the next movie he'll come back and help them.
Oh, that's lame.
It's very Lando.
But, yeah. Okay, that's fair.
I think my biggest gripe overall is how they treated Admiral Akbar.
Off-screen death.
Off-screen death for Admiral Akbar.
Oh, man.
And just a hardcore passing mention.
Yes, you're on with a bunch of Star Wars nerds. I'm sorry.
No, take your time. Take your time. This is all fine. I will say that I whooped out loud when Laura Dern blasted through that other ship.
Oh my god,
that was beautiful.
I think that everyone
was absolutely gorgeous.
Yeah, I saw that in a full theater, and yeah. I could hear people gasping. It was amazing.
Yeah,
yeah,
that was absolutely beautiful.
That got gasps of awe, and when Leia brought herself back into the ship, there were groans in the entire theater.
Likewise.
You know, I thought that they were going to, you know, because Carrie Fisher passed away, I thought they were going to resolve that in this movie.
That would have been fine.
Because my concern is that, and now thinking ahead to whatever the third movie is in this, is that they're going to have her die off screen too.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Start off with a funeral.
Yeah.
She died from old age.
Because it's either that or they do kind of some weird CGI face swapping thing like they do with, you know, to, you know, like they did at the end of Rogue One. Or they could recast her. I don't think so, though.
No. No, they said they aren't going to do any of those shenanigans.
Okay. Ah. I'm still excited to see a new movie, and I'm going to watch this one again. I'm gonna. It's just.
Oh, yeah. In the next week, I will have seen it a second time for sure.
But you're right. It doesn't have. I don't feel the same, like awe around it as really any of the original trilogy movies, nor Force Awakens, nor Rogue One, which I still think is one of my favorite Star Wars films.
The second half of Rogue One is one of the best movies I've seen.
Yeah.
If you average in the first half, it's damn good.
But yeah, I think there's, in the context of the trilogy, it could still work. I just need to see how, you know, the third film goes out, and maybe this film is great. Because I remember when I was a kid, seeing Empire Strikes Back and just being unbearably sad about how they that kind of played out. Just like so much of that they'd set up kind of goes that way, and you know it does have a very kind of different feel than A New Hope did, right? But I think this feels different, and I don't know if that's just because I'm older or what, but it does not have this, you know, it doesn't leave you with the same kind of, like, expectation of the new one. It's more like, okay, you have to resolve these things now, and the expectations are going to be even kind of more interesting for the next one that's coming.
Have we Star Wars'd out?
We might have. And we're getting pretty close to kind of the end of the show, I think. Although we did have at least one more kind of thought, and it is sort of Star Wars related, right?
If you choose the Star Wars holiday special, this podcast is over, Alan.
I found the name of the movie we talked about earlier. It's called Shocker.
Ah, okay.
Where a serial killer is killed in the electric chair, and then his soul goes into the electrical grid to hunt down the high school footballer that ratted him out to the cops. It's available on Amazon Prime. I will see you guys in 2 hours.
All right, so real quick at the end here, we need to have our holiday movie Battle Royale.
Love it.
We all going to name off our favorites. Holiday movie.
Favoritist holiday movie. Okay, I'm ready.
All right, Alan, go ahead.
Who's leading off? I'm leading off with Scrooged.
Yeah,
that's fine.
Saw that coming.
Is it?
Yes.
Yeah, I kind of did.
I love it. It's Bill Murray, first of all, which is awesome.
It's a good film.
Second of all, it is such... I mean, it is a Christmas Carol. It 100% is a Christmas Carol. And yep. yet, it does it in such a way that you don't have that kind of, like, saccharine feeling after watching it. It has enough interestingness and changes that it really makes it its own film.
It's dark.
And yeah, it absolutely has kind of interesting and dark moments. But yeah, it's a great movie.
It's solid. I will go for the Griswold family holiday.
Oh. You know, that's
Christmas
a good
Vacation?
One yeah.
Yes.
That is a solid choice.
National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation.
I love it.
That makes me happy that we both picked the same movie.
Oh, you did? Excellent.
Yeah.
There are two movies that I have to watch every Christmas. It's that one and It's a Wonderful Life. But that's a little bit more on the sappy side.
It's good, though. I think that...
it's a genius classic movie.
You know, being, I think, the, you know, one of the kind of originators of the form helps too, right?
It's true.
I mean, you know, the Scrooged is clearly a reference to existing movies that have been out, right? So that's not a... I mean, it does take it in its own kind of direction, but it definitely is referencing kind of other stuff that's out. If I had to pick kind of a second one, I know Die we Hard. Said we shouldn't pick Die Hard, although Die Hard is a great kind of movie for around the holidays, if only because it is and isn't a holiday movie.
Yes.
It is related to the holidays in that there is a Christmas party, but otherwise, not really. I think a movie that I saw a lot around the holidays and kind of fits in that kind of sphere with me, and I think some entertainment powers that be have turned it into a holiday movie, if only for the line, what is it?
Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn.
No, I wasn't good. Was not going to pick Gone with the Wild. I was going to pick Sound of Music. I feel like that's...
Is that a holiday movie?
I don't think it is.
In the same way that it's a Holocaust movie.
Ouch. I don't think it is a holiday movie, though there Jeez. Is a moment where they talk about... what is it? It's. I thought there's a line about Christmas in the Favorite Things song. I'm going to try and sing Favorite Things in my head without singing it out loud in order to remember the line. But I feel like that has become a movie that they play around this time of year. And I'm fine with that. But it's I don't think that counts because it's not really a holiday movie.
Doesn't qualify in my book.
My second is the one that I have to watch every year. I don't get to Scrooged every year, but every year I watch How the Grinch Stole Christmas. The original.
Mm. Oh, anime. Thank God. Okay.
Not that original abomination.
The original with Jim Carrey?
Oh.
No. So it looks like we're at the end of the podcast.
All right.
Yes.
Well, this has been a great podcast. We are going to probably take a week off, as we do every year for the Not a Thing podcast. We'll try not to take 6 months off this time, but we will take a week off. We will probably not post another show for a little bit of time. In the meantime, please listen to prior shows. Please give us notes about what are things, what are not things. And feel free to let us know if you want to be a guest on the Not a Thing podcast.
Invite yourself.
In the coming year. We'll post this up very shortly. You'll hear the show, you'll listen to it, and then you'll be like, but I want to hear more Not a Thing podcasts. So don't worry. We're coming back in the new year. So in the meantime, Brendan, I'll talk to you later. You're going to have a happy new year.
Happy holidays and a merry new year.
Be good to one another. Until next time.
Always.